thank you for listening to Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy. This is episode 69, Act 1, Adam Odsis Rubin, Building Intentional Queer Spaces, recorded October 29th, 2023.
So damn tired of waiting on a perfect A plus B. The one size fits all prudent kids all screaming about irrevocability. Let's burn some bridges, earn some stitches, and fight our own way free. Cause the rules don't lie, but they don't apply to people like you and me. Let's start it up now. 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 Now they say it's all decided, all divided, all laid out. And the pushcart man with a three-part plan can't understand what you're shouting about. But when the paths they plow, the lives allowed are the only roads you can see. Just remember walls were built to fall for people like you and me. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now.
Hey, TA Podians. Welcome to Teaching Artistry, powered by A Space Between. This podcast is researched, recorded, and produced on the unceded lands, water, and air stewarded by the Canarsie and Munsee Lenape peoples in what is colonially known as Brooklyn, New York. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this indie podcast. Invite your peeps, colleagues, and friends to join our global community and subscribe on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast player. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Teaching Artistry Podcast, and head over to teachingartistry.org to access episodes, guest bios, e-zines, merch, and more. Where were you during the eclipse of 2024? 2024 has been a funky, weird year, has it not? And especially in the last week, it's been, especially in New York City, it's been very naturific around here. We've got earthquakes. We had this crazy thunderstorm where there was lightning that struck the torch of the Statue of Liberty. And then, yeah, there was a total eclipse of the sun. Now, New York City specifically was not in the line of totality of the moon covering the sun, but, you know, close to 90%. So in New York City, it takes a lot for people to sort of stop, look up, and it not be catastrophic, you know, that there's something that we're all sort of taking in and experiencing, hopefully in a positive way. And so this was that experience. That the eclipse was exciting. For me, I was working from home that day. I happened to have the hour between 3 and 4 with no meetings, which is miraculous. So I went up to the roof. I had a host of neighbors were there, people I did not know, some like a handful of people I did know. And it was a real community moment. Luckily we had some of those protective eyewear glasses, so I could see the moon moving into place and then sort of moving around and doing its thing. It never really got like completely dark in New York City or Brooklyn. But I saw amazing images of people who were like in upstate New York, in Canada, and other parts, along the line of totality. Just remarkable, just unbelievable. So yeah, not an easy feat to have people in New York City at least sort of commune and engage with something that is outside of ourselves. So how did you experience it? All right, so let's go, let's get to our guest, shall we? Adam Odsis Rubin. I met Adam as a student in my class at NYU a few years ago, and I've been following his work ever since. He is the founding artistic director of National Queer Theater, which is an organization that focuses on the queer community in a variety of ways. And what I can say is that Adam is quite passionate in general around this work, especially around creating spaces or safe spaces for the queer community and engaging in theater with that community. And so, yeah, it's been a pleasure to get to know him better, to learn more about his work, his journey, his hopes. And in this episode, we learn more about National Queer Theater and its mission, as well as his background in working in community and growing up in the Berkeley area or the Bay Area. Oh, I'm such an East Coaster. The Bay Area. So here is episode 69, Act One, Adam Odsess Rubin, Building Intentional Queer Spaces.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Courtney. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for accepting my invitation. Welcome to the Teaching Artistry podcast. This podcast celebrates artists, culture, and equity. I'm super excited to learn more about you and your journey in arts and arts education and advocacy. And we had a little snippet of learning about the work that you're currently doing. So we'll get started with just a very simple, what I hope is a simple question, is how are you? How are your loved ones doing? What's happening in these days?
Yeah, I'm okay. You know, I think people are feeling very heavy right now with the war in the Middle East and, yeah, just being consumed by the news and current events. But I'm trying to find moments of gratitude, moments of joy, moments of healing, and also moments of distraction, and trying to find balance. And that's like an ongoing kind of project. But personally, I'm doing okay.
Thank you for bringing that into the space. I hear you. I'm just curious, what are some techniques or tactics that you use to find that balance?
You know, I see some friends spiraling, you know, endlessly scrolling through social media, endlessly reading, you know, think pieces. And it's important to be informed and it's important to be engaged. But I think there can be a paralysis in getting consumed in the news. And I think either going to a protest, going to a meeting is a great outlet, or sometimes taking a break and going for a walk is important. Talking to a friend. I think talking to people, talking to Israeli friends, talking with Muslim and Arab friends, like that's been what's been most important for me right now, to really see how I'm feeling, how I can show up, you know, how I can process what's happening in the world. And then taking moments to disengage and watch bad reality TV or go to the park and to not let myself be consumed by sadness. And I feel like this comes up actually in my teaching artist work, because working with marginalized communities, working in highly political spaces, working with students who have experienced high levels of trauma, it's easy to get consumed in that. But I think it's equally important to find joy and help them tap into joy and to give them space to be distracted, to have fun, to be creative, to process. So it's an ongoing experiment.
Yeah, I think all of those tactics are great. And I agree. I'm constantly thinking about how we can acknowledge that we are in, you know, some sort of spiraling moment, and that it's okay, but that there are ways to bring you out, to pause, to rest, and then, yeah, to connect with others in a more joy, to celebrate, to feel joy. And that's not a bad thing. That actually is about filling back in the well so that you can get back out there and do what it is that you need to do in terms of action. Can you share with the audience what is your role, or if you have multiple roles in our field?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the founder, executive director, and artistic director of National Queer Theater based in Brooklyn. I'm also a teaching artist for New York Theater Workshop. I work a lot in their Mind the Gap program. And then I'm also a teaching artist for the Arts Project of Cherry Grove and their Rainbow Connection Intergenerational Queer Summer Camp. And those three places are where I spend the most of my time in the arts and education field.
You and I met in my course, The Teaching Artist at NYU. And we talk a lot about core values in that, like, as a starting point to, like, be able to articulate what are your core values that help you to sort of make as an artist, and then how does that translate into being a teaching artist, and that helps to make some decisions about the kind of work that you want to be pursuing. I'm just curious, do you have any articulated values that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think my personal values align a lot with National Queer Theater's values, and those are belonging, fearlessness, and pride. And I think for me, my way into arts education was as a student in high school doing this production of Laramie Project when I was a closeted gay kid feeling really depressed and anxious. I had experienced a lot of bullying and changed schools. And doing this theater production was incredibly liberating for me. And it was the first time I really felt a sense of pride that I could be queer, I could be gay, and I could be proud of that and not feel shame. So especially in my work with queer youth, it's all about finding the pride. It's all about unlearning the sense of shame and isolation that society teaches queer kids to have, and to embrace ourselves and the fullness of who we are in a way that everyone can have a sense of home and a sense of belonging, even if they don't get that in their, you know, family home. And to do the work with a sense of fearlessness and bravery, because being out, whether it's in New York or Kansas or Uganda, it's hard. It can be challenging, especially for young people, especially for people at, you know, points of multiple marginalizations. And I think it takes a certain level of fearlessness to be out and proud and unashamedly yourself. I think it's a practice that we need to endeavor in every day to be more proud of who we are.
Do you identify as an artist? And if so, what type of artist?
Yeah, I think I'm really in a process right now of discovering the balance between arts administration and my own artistry. I guess right now I'm primarily a director, and I've directed a few smaller things for National Queer Theater. I used to be an actor, and I acted at the Queer Theater in San Francisco, New Conservatory Theater, in a few plays while I was also a teaching artist. So yeah, you know, it's interesting being in a place of leadership with National Queer Theater. I want to create space for other directors. I want to create space for my own artistry, and I don't think I've figured out that puzzle yet. But I have been really proud to, as a director, put on my artistic director hat and be able to support emerging queer directors, emerging trans directors, and really create space and, like, create this partnership of, like, okay, thinking through, like, oh, here's how I would direct this piece. Here's this director's style. And here's how I can support them in their creative vision. And if I can be a mentor, if I can be a partner, being on that journey with them.
Yeah, I want to learn more about the kinds of partnerships and who you're working with. And you've named these three different roles, working as a teaching artist and having multiple roles at the Queer Theater, both executive director, artistic director. How big is your staff?
Our staff fluctuates. I'm the only full-time employee. I work with Rose Ozer, who is our part-time producing director. Two wonderful interns, a grant writer, and an EDI and anti-racism consultant, Dr. Darrell Cooper. We have a small board of directors. It's a small organization, but it's been growing quickly. And, you know, I would love to have more staff to continue supporting the work. But I'm really proud of our team for building this organization from nothing into what I think is an important touchstone in the New York City cultural scene.
What was the origin story of founding this company?
In 2018, I was at NYU. I was taking your class, Courtney. And Joe Salvatore, one of the professors, asked us to write a fake grant proposal as one of the assignments. And I wrote a real grant proposal and I got some real money. And I had always wanted to start a theater company. I had always been excited and interested in queer political activism, in new play development, in arts education. And working at the Queer Theater in San Francisco and seeing their model, I saw how they really harnessed the power of queer theater to uplift youth and to uplift artists and uplift communities. And I felt like I could really do that in New York City. And I felt like there was a strong need for community building in New York, especially amongst like 20, 30 something newcomers to New York who were both looking for artistic opportunities, but really looking for queer community and looking to make friends and looking for a sense of connection. And within the queer community, because so many people are rejected by their parents, rejected by their families, or isolated from their families, there's this strong idea of chosen family. And I think theater being such a site of community building can really be a place to find chosen family. And my goal has always been with the theater that it feels like a home for queer artists in New York. And people will come in and out, but I hope that our artists feel like it's a home base for them. And the theater, you know, it really grew organically and really talking with folks, you know, what do you want from a queer theater? How can National Queer Theater serve you? And I think having a kind of like grandiose name, it really helped us find individuals who are excited about the work we're doing, who would take a chance on a new company given the mission because they were looking for that sense of connection. We're also just really lucky to have some great early supporters like Broadway Cares, really stepped up. Stonewall Community Foundation gave us some of our first grants, and I think having that early seed funding is really what enabled us to become a legitimate organization and not just kind of stay at the grad student project level, but like really invest in infrastructure, in fundraising, in marketing, and you know, these things you need to build a theater company, to be able to offer the kinds of programs we offer. So yeah, it's been a whirlwind. It's all happened so quickly over the past 5-6 years, but I'm so proud of where we've come as a theater company, going from performing in the basements of bars to Lincoln Center. It's kind of surreal.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you could share what are some of the programs that are going on, have been going on, and talking about those partnerships.
Yeah, absolutely. So most people probably know National Queer Theater for our Criminal Queerness Festival, which is the official theater event of New York City Pride. And the Criminal Queerness Festival aims to uplift international LGBTQ artists from countries that criminalize queer communities or censor queer artists. So if you are a, let's say, a lesbian playwright in Kenya, you can't produce queer theater. And so we received a new play from Egypt in 2018, and the playwright was not able to do the play in Egypt, and we said we would do this play in New York City. And that kind of started the idea for this Criminal Queerness Festival, and we're on our sixth year, planning towards our sixth year at the PAC NYC at the World Trade Center, and we've been able to showcase artists from all over the world. And really do a lot of community engagement around international queer rights and decriminalization worldwide. We also offer a lot of free education programs, including Dreaming Out Loud with New York Theater Workshop in Pen America, which is taught by Victor Caceres, which is a paid playwriting workshop for undocumented and immigrant youth. we partner with Donye Love and Broadway Cares on Write It Out, which is a free playwriting class for people living with HIV, which is virtual and across the country. At the end of the semester, the students write 10-minute plays, and we hire professional actors to perform their work to expand the canon for representation of people living with HIV. And then our new program that started just in January is Staging Pride Queer Youth Theater, which is our own free after-school program at the LGBT Center. And that's funded by the Matisse Foundation, which has been an incredible partner. And we offer free acting classes for queer and trans youth ages 12 to 18, and really a network of support and a place to meet other queer kids and build community and make friends and have fun and be silly. And ultimately, they devise their own performance and perform it for family and friends. And it's really, really special.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I want to know, like, yeah, what's underneath for Adam for all these different programs, these different ways at building connection and community? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think I'm looking for community. Like, I think I'm that artist who needed the artistic home. I'm that queer actor who needed roles to play that were meaningful, that were not just having, you know, theaters casting straight actors to play queer roles. I think I need that sense of connection and that sense of home and family. And I think about like 16-year-old Adam, who was, you know, beat up and bullied and isolated and depressed, and like what I needed at that time. And I needed supportive adults and supportive friends and queer community and recognition and visibility. And, you know, I also grew up pretty privileged, and I grew up, you know, white cis guy in California. So I think the needs are even more immediate for some of our artists and students who are queer and trans people of color, people living with HIV, immigrants. There's a lot of need in the community, and especially right now with all this anti-LGBTQ legislation that's trying to, that Republican politicians are trying to jam through Congress at the state and the national level, I see a lot of urgency in the work, and I see it both as artistic creative work, but really for me, it's political work. It's my own way of being involved in queer activism through the arts, through kind of community engaged arts.
Listening to you speak, I'm reminded of a past guest named Rebab, and she's based in Wales, and does a lot of like deep community work. And we talked a lot about what some of the practices of working with the staff are. Do you see your administrative practices mirroring the sort of programmatic or approaches or the way that you're building connections and community? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It's a great question. I think it's really tricky. I would like to say everything is totally aligned and in concert with each other, but I think the admin work, there feels like, it feels like there's a different level of pressure that I wouldn't ever want to put on my students or actors in a rehearsal process. I think pedagogically, you know, when I'm in the classroom, I'm trying to take pressure off, and, you know, however you show up in the room is great. It doesn't matter if you're talented or untalented, or, you know, even if you didn't do the homework, that's okay, and we'll survive. But, you know, when you're running a nonprofit, you know, you have to do things correctly, and you have to get the work done. And so it's to me, it's a bit more of a struggle to like find the softness in that work, to find the moments of rest in that work, because I feel responsible not just for the staff, but all the artists. And, you know, we have to send contracts and we have to send payments, and we have to be organized to support the artists and the students and the teachers. And I think there's a big burden on the administrative staff to, you know, be really on top of things in a way that I wouldn't expect from, maybe I would expect from actors, but certainly not from students. You know, there's a lot more grace. So I think there's room to give ourselves more grace, but I think also to have that room, you know, we need capacity. And it means not being understaffed or under-resourced, but as a really small arts organization, like that's the reality. We are understaffed and we are under-resourced. So given those things, the question becomes, how do we create more space to be gentler with ourselves, to slow down a little bit? And, you know, the main solution we've come up with is to do less, which I think makes sense logically, but emotionally feels like, wait, but there's so much we have to do. There's so much urgency. And how can I say no to XYZ program when it's working with this community that we're trying to uphold, trying to support? How do we choose between two important programs? Like, how do we do less without sacrificing our core mission or letting down our community? But ultimately, if the work isn't sustainable, like, it's not going to be helpful to people 10 years down the line if there's no National Queer Theater to show up when there's need there. So, yeah, I don't know if I have a great solution, but it's definitely something I'm thinking about a lot.
Well, I'm happy to lab it here because I don't expect there to be a nifty answer for this kind of question, because I think a lot of folks are challenged or struggle with this. I was thinking about, I work with a partnership group, three different organizations, and we're looking at, you know, trying to support educators, arts educators, to create more liberated spaces for students in terms of access, students with disabilities, and any student who basically all learners, right? But from that sort of lens, which can have tendrils towards other kinds of ways of creating spaces where everybody feels like they belong, but that's our particular lens. And we're constantly having, you know, pushback on ourselves about how we're working, how are we modeling and embedding the ways that we're modeling those practices to the workshop participants inside how we work together as a partnership group. And and with our teaching artists teams, and when there's a, you know, a calling in that can happen, and it happens, it's taken very, very seriously. And there feels like a lot of urgency because we want to respond, but we actually have to practice the same thing with ourselves of like, we need to have a meeting. We need to have an agenda in advance. We need to take breaks while we're in this meeting if it's longer than X amount of time. We need to do all those things. And we have to come up with a real understanding of what, you know, what the core issue is, so we can address it appropriately and then make, you know, strong, you know, guidelines for how to ensure that thing doesn't happen again, or that there's a strategy for addressing that in future if it does happen, right? Like, and that way of working is, for me, is not, I want to say new, but that it's the frame. I think the framework is a little bit different, where one person might advocate for themselves. This scope of work is really aiming to get learners to be able to understand how they can advocate for themselves, but also that we're gonna be working to impact the field so that there are other advocates and allies in your world as you're advocating for yourself in terms of a learning environment. And that's actually the first time I thought about that way. I personally can't speak for anybody else, but like that, so that idea of like, how do we give ourselves, if we're trying to create liberated spaces, how do we create liberated spaces of work? And so that starts to permeate other areas of our working week or work week. And you know, I hear a lot of folks on my team who are like, recently there, we had a little retreat, and there was like, there's so much to do. It's hard to like prioritize sometimes. And then, you know, the peaks and the valleys, there's less and less space between the two. And I would love to find a way to create more. And I don't have an answer for that, but I really appreciated that conversation. And now it's like out there. So how do we figure that out? How do we create opportunities? And your peaks and valleys are at different times of the year. So what will be a like really intense time for one team member may be not as intense time for another. And how do we see each other and care for each other in those times is another part of the conversation. There's deadlines and there's things to get done. And it is, again, about the people that are working or participating in our programs that we're caring for. There's a lot of caring, but how do we also care for each other and ourselves inside of caring for others and creating community? It's a constant conversation.
You know, I think we also have to recognize that this work is incredibly personal. You know, I think especially in teaching artistry work, when we're working with students, like, yeah, we are caring for other human beings who are impressionable. So, you know, even a conversation around getting supplies feels like emotional almost, because teachers care so much for their students, which is a good thing. And also, you know, I think as people who employ teaching artists, we're also asking them in some ways kind of to be social workers. And especially, you know, when working with marginalized queer youth, as we are at National Queer Theater, sometimes even without the parents being fully aware of, you know, the students' involvement in the program because of kids being in the closet, it's a huge responsibility. And not only are we dealing with, you know, how to be good at improv, it might be like dealing with mental health issues. It might be dealing with undiagnosed disabilities. It might be dealing with food insecurity or violence in their neighborhood. There's so many layers. And so I think I've definitely seen that both as a teacher artist and supervising teacher artist, bleeding over into kind of the administrative side, into the way we talk about doing the work, the way we talk about planning the work. And it can be draining. It can be emotional. And I think we have to give ourselves grace for that and give ourselves understanding and take a bit more time, because it's not just budgets and spreadsheets. It's, you know, real people's lives.
Budgets and spreadsheets were... It's people's lives. Absolutely. I mean, what a statement, Adam. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I get really tripped up with like dealing with government and the amount of bureaucracy there is and how like we're just trying to help people. why is it this hard? Wow. You're very passionate. But like with a chill vibe, but you're very passionate. I like it. I dig it. It does make me, I do want to go to your past if that's okay. Growing up, you talked about growing up in, you've said San Francisco a couple times. So I was just curious, where in California did you grow up?
I grew up in Berkeley. My parents were two hippie therapists who met at UC Santa Cruz in an intro to Marxism class. And I later went to Santa Cruz, which is great. And that informed a lot of, I think, who I am as a person and who I am in my work. Berkeley is like a tremendously political place to grow up, with like a rich history of political activism, and also has experienced a total transformation since the tech industry came in. It also has really amazing culture and theater. Like I grew up going to Berkeley Rep. And taking classes at ACT, and I later did a fellowship at ACT, and that was my first like arts education gig. I think about kind of bringing the Bay Area style to New York a lot, and for me that sense of community engaged work really was developed studying at UC Santa Cruz and growing up in a place like Berkeley, which is a very unique environment.
And then what made you come to New York?
I came to New York because I got into NYU to study with my wonderful professors. You know, it felt like, I guess I'd maybe hit a little bit of a career ceiling in San Francisco. The theater scene in San Francisco is amazing, and there's some incredible artists and great organizations. But just in terms of scale, I mean, there's only really maybe 5 or 6 theaters you can work for that can pay you a living wage, especially given how expensive it is to live in the Bay Area. And I'd worked with a few different youth nonprofits. I had the pleasure of working for Cleve Jones as his executive assistant. He was Harvey Milk's mentee and created the AIDS Quilt. He created the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Really an amazing activist. And I got to work with him for a few years. But I think I knew that if I wanted to, you know, really make an impact in the theater world, even if I went back to San Francisco, I had to spend time in New York. You know, definitely in the regional theater world, like, we love to amp up our local scene. And I was definitely doing that in the Bay Area. But unfortunately, like, I heard from institutions like ACT and Berkeley Rep that if you want to be successful in the San Francisco theater, you have to be in New York. It's ironic, and I would love to undo that. But being in New York now, I you know, the drive and the persistence and the striving for excellence, it is really inspiring, and it is really motivating. And I don't regret coming to New York because it's taught me so much and pushed me so much in my career.
There are some questions that are popping into my head about regional theater and the challenges that they're facing in this moment. Bay Area Children's Theater closed last year, and quite a few others have had, and there are some here in New York that have also had, like, to downsize and excise staff. And, you know, I know that you're not this, like, institution. Do you have a actual brick and mortar space?
National Queer Theater doesn't. I would love to eventually, but it's also been really exciting to work in different spaces. I've done a few shows at the Eagle, which is, for those of you who don't know, New York's premier gay leather bar. Imagine, like, Tom of Finland, like, muscly daddies wearing leather harnesses. The owner of the Eagle loves theater and invited me to put up shows there, which has been really crazy and fun and exciting and different. And then we've also gotten to do shows at, like, Lincoln Center and partner with Carnegie Hall and work with New York Theater Workshop at MCC Theater. It's a bit of a pain trying to adapt to every different venue's way of operating and working and partnering and what partnership means to them. But it is exciting to be able to work all over New York City. And, you know, after 5 years, we've been able to kind of delve deeper into our partnerships with certain venues, like the new Brooklyn Art House in Williamsburg has been amazing. I'm so excited to go to the Perlman at the World Trade Center and work with Bill Rausch there. And yeah, to really, you know, understand what New Yorkers want and the little differences of each neighborhood and the different feeling and how we can adapt to the environment we're in for different projects. And, yeah, but, you know, in terms of thinking about creating a home for queer artists, I would love to eventually have that be our own space where we can, you know, maybe offer free rehearsal space to queer artists or meeting space to queer activist groups, and have a real center for queer performance in New York.
Can you talk about how the partnership with the Perlman came about or is coming about? Because that's a space that just opened, right? It's been in the works for a really long time. And there's, you know, there's a question in the zeitgeist of, like, do we need it? Does New York City really need another performing arts space? But maybe it does. And what a exciting place to be and a poignant place to have a new theater space in the World Trade Center. Yeah, let's just talk about that. talk about that, and then talk about why do they want to partner with you, do you think?
Yeah, I think it was Linda Chevin at New York Theater Workshop who first introduced me to Bill Rausch, who is the artistic director of the Perlman. He was a founder of Cornerstone Theater in LA, which is a really amazing community-engaged theater company. And then obviously was the artistic director of Oregon Shakespeare Festival for a number of years. And Bill has just been a tremendous champion of our work. You know, he came to some of our criminal queerness festivals in the past few years. In 2021, we performed like on the street through the New York City Open Culture Program in front of the UN. We performed at Lincoln Center. And he's just really loved this idea of promoting international queer playwrights who might not otherwise be able to produce their work in their home countries. And I think the fact that the Perlman focuses on international work and the fact that Bill is queer and wants to support queer artists and was looking for programming for their Pride season next June, I think it was a natural fit. And he's just been an amazing thought partner in terms of how we can utilize that space and how we can really dig deeper into the impact side of the festival, not just the artistic side, but really thinking about who's going to be in the audience, how are we engaging people outside of the theater, and how are we really showing up for our artists. And so, you know, we started a number of conversations thinking about what would co-producing look like, what would presenting look like, thinking about how we're scheduling the festival. And I'm really thrilled that we'll be there next June across the hall from Bill's crazy new production of Cats with Jalen Livingston and a number of incredible artists. And I think to produce international playwrights at the World Trade Center, yeah, it does feel really poignant. You know, even producing like queer Muslim work at this site that birthed so much Islamophobia in America feels really powerful. And I'm still thinking about, like, you know, what is the deeper meaning of doing this in this particular space? But I mean, when you walk out of the front doors of the Perlman, you are looking into the memorial pools of the Twin Towers. It's an incredibly emotional space and an incredibly beautiful theater. And I don't think there can ever be like too many art spaces. You know, I'm sure Lincoln Center and BAM are like not super happy to have more competition for funding or artists or whatever. But, you know, for a small theater like us to have the opportunity to have that platform is incredible and will bring in more donors and volunteers and artists into our work, new audiences for sure. So yeah, it's a huge accomplishment for us.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, I think there's something to be said about having the flexibility to make other people's homes yours, or have them, you know, invite you in so that you can create connection and community for their, you know, particular constituents. I'm wondering if you've ever considered like theater for the very young or theater for young audiences as part of the scope of potential partnerships and engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, within the queer community, it's that's like not very neutral work. I think, you know, operating in a world with Fox News and people calling us like groomers, like we really have to be safe and protective when thinking about the work we do with young people. And I'm very grateful that we're able to partner with the Center for our Staging Pride program, because they have a security guard. And we have to think about that, because there are people out there who would not be happy to know that we're doing a theater program with queer youth. And, you know, we've been called groomers online, and, you know, people comment on our Facebook post that we're, you know, sinners, and they quote Bible verses, and yeah, it's really highly politicized for our community. I had the great pleasure of doing drama workshop with a elementary school gay straight alliance, which like blew my mind that that even existed. I'd never even heard of a middle school gay straight alliance, let alone elementary school gay straight alliance. And I did an improv workshop around the graphic novel Heartstopper, which is like a really sweet graphic novel and Netflix show. Highly recommend. But we could only do that in New York City. I mean, I talk with my colleagues in the South, in the Midwest, and they talk a lot about security, and they're worried about the Proud Boys coming into their theaters. So, you know, what would it even mean for us to do theater for young audiences? And how do we specifically serve queer youth, and where do queer youth gather? Because I think we're less interested in teaching straight and cis people to accept us. Like, there are people who do that work. And that's like a lot of queer theater on Broadway is like, we're equal, like give us equal rights. But I'm more interested in like an internal conversation within our community of like, what are the issues that we need to work out amongst ourselves? And when we work with youth, like we're working specifically with queer youth and specifically in an after school setting, because in schools, obviously it would be like a mixed population. Yeah, it's complicated. It's really, really complicated. And unfortunately, it's really political, which you shouldn't be, because young people deserve great theater and young queer people deserve great theater. But, you know, I think that'll be a conversation we can have in 20 years. And I hope things are much easier and much more open. But yeah, unfortunately, we have to think about safety. Which is a shame.
Well, I appreciate your answer. And because I work where I work and we present all sorts of different stories, that I wasn't picking up on what you had said earlier about like, we're really trying to create space for queer, kids and, you know, young people, emerging adults and beyond, that, you know, in our audiences, we don't ask those questions. We don't know how folks identify, but that our doors are open and our stories being told on stage could make connections in some way. And we definitely have had a few stories where like the main character was gay or lesbian or something, you know, like it was queer, and that needed to be handled with some sensitivity, but we didn't get to that. It was a different time, maybe. So we weren't having to deal with things from that very intense and acute political perspective in the same kind of way that you're talking about now. And it is something that we all have to be aware of, and we all have to be, you know, very intentional about how we're approaching audiences in general. And then with that layer, if there happens to be a show that feels like it could draw that kind of ire, or protest or what have you, or violence. That said, I am interested, as you're still building out, I'm interested in that conversation and seeing what could be possible in some 10-year future, some, you know, future plan around this, because I believe that it's not about like indoctrination. Obviously, it's about creating queer affirming spaces also. And that's something that another guest, upcoming guest will, or at this point, yeah, another guest, that's sort of their perspective on writing a book and creating like a podcast and a YouTube show is about, you know, supporting young people who are questioning or identify as being a part of the queer community, and thinking about parenting and supporting parents to create a home that is gender affirming or queer affirming. And so it makes me wonder about artists then, like if there's a world where you have artists who identify as queer artists who might be interested in developing a piece of work that could be for a young audience of their targeted, you know, age range, that there are theaters that focus for young audiences to be in conversation with at the very least, right? Like there's a world for that, and then all those other kinds of conversations, yes, come into the conversation.
I mean, I think one of my goals for our after school program, Staging Pride, this will take some time to develop, but I would love for the youth to devise their performance and then like tour it to schools. I've seen this model at different theaters around the country, but for the young people to really be leaders in educating other young people would be really exciting for me, because I think nobody's going to understand queer youth really except other queer youth, and like the pace of progress is so quick in terms of how young people speak about themselves, about how they speak about identity, how they speak about gender. Like, we can be supportive adults, but like they're in a totally different universe that's amazing, and that has changed so quickly. I mean, thinking just, you know, Stonewall was only like 50 years ago. Like, this is such a new and quickly evolving movement. So I think using devising in our theater program, like many youth theater programs, has been a really powerful tool for letting young people create their own stories and their own narratives, because there's not a lot of plays written for, you know, a group of 10 trans and queer teenagers, but, you know, they're able to develop that. So I think that could be a way into the kind of work you're talking about in terms of theater for a young audience. I also got to direct for Keen Teens through Keen Company, and was directing a TYA piece by Kit Yan and Melissa Lee, who are two incredible queer musical theater writers. And it was kind of about cancel culture in a high school gay straight alliance. And unfortunately the musical got canceled because of COVID. The great irony of my theater life. But we were working with a fantastic cast of queer and allied teens, and it was going to be performed by, you know, for other young people. And I think that's fantastic. I don't think, you know, National Queer Theater being a small new company, like, there's just only so many things we can do. And again, I'm trying to, like, do less in order to do more, to think about how can we focus the quantity to really enhance the quality. I would rather do a great after-school program than try to do, you know, 20 in-school residencies.
No, I like it. It sounds like you have ideas to put on a parking lot and things to strive for. But I think going at a methodical, and maybe methodical is not the right word, but like going at a pace that is about depth and breath, and breath, I mean, not breath with a D, but breath, breathing, feels really, really right to me, actually. And I appreciate that you're on that pathway. I wanted to share, there was something else that you talked about in terms of the, you know, the conversations within the community itself. Something I talk about with some folks, I don't know, but I belong to, have you heard of playback theater? So I belong to there's lots of troupes like around the globe, and they all have some sort of focus. And I belong to a troupe called the New York City Queer Playback Theater. And so our main audience is what you said earlier, like the queer community and allied folks. And in terms of the performers, we're a mix of queer identifying and folks and folks who are in solidarity. And the premise of this work is that the audience volunteers to tell a story that is connected to whatever the theme of the show is for them. And there's a conductor who's essentially interviewing the storyteller, and then the performers listen deeply and play back or reenact their story via some sort of improv form. And the way we practice is that we are the ones who are telling the story. So the performers are telling, you know, volunteering to tell a story, and then we perform it or reenact it. And it's been, I've been working in this company for a little more than three years. And I started in the pandemic, and, you know, initially I was just like, I just need a creative outlet, and I'm very happy to be here. But now it's like the amount of bravery, of the storytellers floors me every time. And like, I've seen some really intense moments within our community, you know, when we're in rehearsals, of like the depth to which folks will share. And obviously what happens there stays there. So it's, I'm not going to share any of those stories, but like, I'm that caretaking, and that, you know, want to reenact another's story who's been deeply impacted by something, whether it's bullying or, you know, conversations with loved ones, et cetera. And they're crying and telling these stories of conflict. And then you find your own connection, but you can't layer your own thing in there. You know, so there's a big dance that goes on. It's a real practice in empathy, and a real practice in that deep, like I said, deep listening, like the three levels of listening, and being able to, I don't want to say gift, but like, we usually end with, like, especially if we're on Zoom, with our hands out like this, as a, like, you know, here you go. Thank you for sharing, and we're now giving it back to you. And there's something really humbling about that. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with you, that I've really been very impacted by being in more, you know, queer affirming spaces, as somebody who is not as vocal about their queerness as others are, that it's helped me to feel like I made a connection in a community that I didn't always feel like I was a part of. Definitely, you know, allied, but didn't necessarily feel like I was also like somebody who needed to allyship. You know what I'm saying?
Thank you for listening to episode 69, Act 1 of Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy, Adam Odsis Rubin, Building Intentional Queer Spaces. Join us next time for Act 2. This podcast is edited and produced by Ben Weber. Christopher Totten is the director of creative content. Jonna Waldman wrote and performed the theme song. Tim Palin designed the logo. Visit us at www.teachingartistry.org and head to the pod shop at the top of the page for merch. Find us on Instagram at Teaching Artistry Podcast. And now on YouTube, check out the Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy channel and watch We Can't Go Back. Like our page on Facebook, listen to us on SoundCloud and Spotify, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to share this podcast with all the teaching artists in your life.
Let's start it up now. Ooh.